From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A week from tomorrow, South Carolinians will head to polls for the Democratic primary. They'll be on the scene next week, broadcasting live from South Carolina on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. But this is a split primary. Tomorrow, the Republican voters get their say. My colleague Michelle Norris hosts NPR's All Things Considered. She's been in South Carolina all this past week. How you doing?
Hello, Farai.
So you have been to rallies for the Republican frontrunners, Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee, John McCain. What's the mood?
Well, you know, the mood is always upbeat, and there's a lot of enthusiasm in that room. We should say that we've been attending the rallies of the Republican candidates because most of the Democrats are west of the Mississippi. They're focused on that primary on Saturday in Nevada right now. So we've been really have only had a chance to see the Republicans this week. And it's so interesting when you go to these rallies, you really get to compare the candidates and their supporters. Mitt Romney, for instance, came here on the heels of that big victory in Michigan, showed up here at a rally that was surprisingly small and surprisingly low-key, given that he came here with a bit more wind in his sails. John McCain at a rally, you really get to see that he is pretty much the establishment candidate. A lot of the people who supported George Bush last time around, the elected officials in the state, big money men and women, are now lined up in his camp and really stressing his experience, his ability to lead on day one. Mike Huckabee, very different scene. Much more of a populist candidate. And in that room, you see a lot more middle-income people, a lot of evangelicals, a lot of homeschoolers. You got a big boost from them, a lot of support in Iowa. You see that again here, a lot of kids in the room dragged there with their parents, or at least brought there by their parents, who identified themselves as homeschoolers. And he stresses more of his ability to lead based on his time as governor. And he's also much more of a charming speaker. People that we spoke to there said that they were inspired by him. They liked his personal story.
Now, what about Rudy Giuliani? He has been holding back, waiting until Florida, but this has been such a frantic race. What's going on for him?
That's an interesting question. You said, what about Rudy Giuliani? We heard that from people here. What's up with Rudy Giuliani? He has not spent a lot of time here. He came, he saw, he spoke at that debate in Myrtle Beach, and then he got on a plane and left and didn't come back. He has looked past South Carolina. His strategy is to focus on Florida, hoping that he can score a big win there and get back in the game. Folks down here don't like that so much. They take their place in this process very seriously. They expect the candidates to come here and court their vote. They, on the Republican side, no nominee has gone on to win the nomination, the GOP nomination, without first winning the Palmetto State, without first winning here since 1980. So it's really a risky strategy for him. And if he did show here up here at this point, I'm not sure he would get such a warm reception because people don't much like the fact that he basically dissed them.
So considering that this state has had a pivotal role in predicting who's going to go on to win the Republican nomination, who's being favored at this point by the pollsters?
Well, you know, woe to anybody who makes predictions, particularly after New Hampshire. So, you know, even the people who are paid to make predictions here, who usually are really good at that, are backing away from this and saying it's anyone's game at this point. It is really a tight race, both on the Republican and the Democratic side. John McCain and Mike Huckabee are running neck and neck here. It's very, very close. John McCain, as I said, really, you know, winning a lot of support from the establishment. Also, the large military presence in the state, people who have family members who have loved ones who are serving in the military, large number of veterans here.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. You were at a historically black college in Columbia. What'd you hear from the students?
I heard from students who said they were planning to vote. Benedict apparently has been making a push to make sure that students vote. Along the campus, you see these signs that show the school's mascot and a big word vote underneath it, so they're really pushing students to get out. We heard a lot of indecision, students who were planning to vote, and if they had decided on a candidate, you sort of heard a bit of, they weren't quite sure that they had completely sealed the deal. We also talked to students who were undecided, had not yet decided, usually between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And that reflects what you're seeing in the broader electorate here. So close to the election, as you saw in Iowa and New Hampshire, so many people are still undecided. Polls show as many as 50% of the Democratic voters still have not made up their mind. And so the polls show that Barack Obama has pulled out slightly ahead of Hillary Clinton, but it still is a very tight race. You know, you've seen a lot of movement and a lot of discussion and a very heated debate in recent days over this war of words over the issue of race between the candidates and their surrogates. Some say that that has had an effect here on the race. We certainly have heard that from the voters that we've talked to here, who feel that the Clinton campaign was not playing fair, was speaking in code. On the other hand, some people say that the Obama campaign saw an opening there and used this as an opportunity to really sort of exploit that issue. Some of the analysts who look at this say that this issue, this war of words, this introduction or injection of the issue of race may have helped Barack Obama with black voters. It may have helped Hillary Clinton with white voters. And you see that when you look at the polls, which show this interesting that's happening with the coalition that Obama has put together. He doesn't seem to be putting together the multi-ethnic coalition that we saw in Iowa and New Hampshire. Among white voters in the early polls, he is number three in terms of support from white voters here in South Carolina, behind Hillary Clinton there in first place and John Edwards in second place. So you when you really get behind the sort of first blush of the polls and sort of look deep into them, into the demographics and the gender issues and even income issues, you see some really interesting things, but still a week to go.
All right. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for that update.
Thank you. And when you get down here, Farai, there's a big bowl of shrimp and grits waiting for you.
Oof. I'm all over that. That was NPR's Michelle Norris from the studios of Educational TV in Columbia, South Carolina. And you've got the split primary in South Carolina, Republicans this weekend, Democrats next. But this Saturday in Nevada, both parties put their chips on the table for caucus day. We've got our reporters' roundtable to give us more. Beth Fooey of the Associated Press covers presidential politics, and she is in Nevada now. Marcus Mabry is international business editor for the New York Times, and Clarence Page is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
Hey, Farai.
So, Beth, you are just on a tear. You covered Hillary Clinton's visit to Compton, California this week. Now you're in a totally different state. Set the scene for us in Nevada. What's the vibe?
Well, it's really interesting, Farai. It's a caucus state like Iowa, but unlike Iowa, where the caucuses have been part of the fabric of political tradition for quite some time, the whole emphasis on Nevada's caucuses is very new to voters here, and a lot of them still don't really know what's going on. So it's really been a challenge for these candidates to get their teams on the ground to identify their voters and get them out to vote. It's the typical challenges that caucuses always provide, but it's especially tough here because you're dealing with, as I said, a population that's not particularly used to it, a very demographically diverse population with a lot of Hispanic voters. So they're definitely facing a lot more obstacles to getting this pulled off than they ever did in Iowa. On the other hand, it gives both candidates, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, a pretty good opportunity here because it is so new and they're relying on different types of support. Clinton's got a lot of support from the Democratic establishment here. Her campaign is being run by Harry Reid's son, the Senate Majority Leader's son, Rory Reid, while Obama's got the endorsement of a very powerful union in Las Vegas, the culinary workers, who are actively organizing for him. So I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen, honestly. It's very, very much up in the air. Even John Edwards is still a player here, so we will know in about 24 hours what's going to happen.
Marcus, where do you think the reporting pack is going to go next? I don't mean literally state to state. I mean issue to issue. This week was all race all the time. Where do you see the conversation going next?
Well, you know, Farai, the amazing thing about this race to me is that anything we think we know, anything we predict as the next thing to happen in this race turns out to be wrong. So there is no way that I'm going to take a guess on what issue they go to next. So far, what we've seen as far as the issues coverage, and I think, unfortunately, I think in this election, like in almost every election, sadly, in our country so far, we have not actually done a good job of covering the issues. And so what we see is the issue became race after there was, you know, a slip-up on the part of Hillary Clinton, supposedly, and on the part of former President Clinton. That's when it became an issue. Not because we were talking about policy prescriptions or about visions of America's future. It happened because there was a gaffe on the campaign trail. And that is just such horrible, superficial coverage, unfortunately. And that's what we're seeing again. So I can't tell you what the next issue will be. But I think it is going to be hilarious, actually, literally, though. You said this wasn't the question, but to see where does the reporting pack go next, geographically. I think it's going to be fascinating to see. Obviously, they'll converge in South Carolina, but after that, you know, when we head towards Super Duper Tuesday, where is everyone going to be? And it's not just us, but it's the same thing with the candidates. This is the wackiest presidential campaign we've ever seen.
So you're saying that you think that basically personality politics are winning out over substantive politics in reporting.
And I guess some people might say, well, oh, there's a surprise. But yeah, I think it's true. And I think it's sad because I think every year we hope it'll be different. But every year it's the same.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. If you're just joining us, we've been talking politics and more on our Reporters Roundtable. We've got Marcus Mabry, International Business Editor for the New York Times, Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Beth Fooey, who covers presidential politics for the Associated Press. So welcome back, guys. Clarence, I'm going to go straight to you. When you've had people walk up to you on the street and ask about this race, you wrote a column about one of those examples. What are people asking you?
What are people? that column was about a. Let me see. Refresh my memory for I could, as a columnist. I never remember what I've said, but I believe that columnist was asking me, that person was asking me about Barack, right?
Yeah, why Obama lost New Hampshire.
That was it, right? Okay. that was the question, and she wanted. The thing that struck me was she said, just. A one-word answer, because she's in a hurry, like everybody is. I said, there's no way to answer that in one word, and that's why I write columns. But it was my own answer to the question as to why I lost, in short, was the female factor. Marcus is right. We've been, we journalists have had a heck of a time making predictions, especially New Hampshire seemed to be way off, and everybody's speculating. But the best information I've been able to receive is that the polls were right on Barack Obama's turnout, but did anticipate a larger than expected turnout among independent women, in particular for Hillary Clinton. But that was last week's narrative, as you mentioned, and now we wait to see what the next narrative is going to be.
I actually want to turn to the economy. You cannot say it's the economy, stupid, enough in an election year or in a year when America's future seems to rest on a knife's edge. And yesterday, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke took the mic here. He did a little bit talking about how the economy needs a boost. Here's a bit of his statement before the House Budget Committee.
Fiscal measures that involve long lead times or result in additional economic activity only over a protracted period, whatever their intrinsic merits might be, will not provide stimulus when it is most needed.
Now, that was kind of dense language, Marcus, but basically, does the Fed chair have a plan? And if so, what is it?
I think if we watch what Wall Street has done, as far as the close yesterday, down some 300 points, the close the day before that, the long-term trend we've seen, the worst beginning of a year we've seen in decades, I think the stock market speaks as far as its faith in the Fed chair. Unfortunately for Chairman Bernanke, there's no faith that he has a plan. And, even in his testimony, he said, we really have to do something. I'm not going to tell you what we should do, but we really have to do something to ease what's going to be, what looks like we're headed for a recession. We need to do something to ease all this for, especially those loan holders who are in trouble. And that number is going to increase throughout our country. And the fear, of course, is that the problems in the housing market and the subprime bad loans that were sent out, and that lots of banks, huge banks like Citigroup hold, and billions of dollars of loans that they've made that they're going to have to write off because they will never be repaid because they were bad loans, that all those problems are seeping out into the rest of the economy now. So Americans are pulling back, and finally, the American consumer who always spent no matter what happened, and that's how we kept this economy going, is stopping all that spending. And that's the fear. No one, the administration doesn't have a plan. The Fed chairman certainly doesn't have the plan. And I feel for the guy because Wall Street really hates him right now. And every time we see the stock market down hundreds of points, that's Wall Street saying, we think this guy's a boob. Unfortunately, I think there's going to be a lot of pain in this presidential year, and I think that's going to be incredibly bad for the Republicans. But also, it's going to be a challenge for the Democrats, because the Republicans will get to say what the American people need now are for the President Bush's tax cuts to be made permanent. We can't increase the taxes on Americans, and just by letting those tax cuts, the tax breaks that Bush gave, largely, it's true, to the very well-off, just by letting those expire, which they would do if Congress does nothing, the Republicans will paint that as the Democrats raising taxes on Americans. And the Republican candidates will say, you cannot raise taxes on Americans when we're in the middle of a recession or headed toward a recession where the American people are going to be hurting already economically. They can't increase their taxes.
Now, Beth, the president just today called for $145 billion worth of tax relief. When you go out on the trail, do people have their own plans? And what I mean by that is not the politicians, but the citizens. As you go around doing your reporting, do people ever say, well, if I was president, blank, or how are people processing this?
Oh, they do. And of course, I'm covering Senator Clinton, so we speak to entirely Democratic audiences for the most part, and their concerns are very much about the economic bad economic picture that we're facing right now. Everybody's very, very concerned about health care. Everybody's very concerned about whether their jobs are secure. The economy has become absolutely the focus on the campaign trail in the last, I'd say, at least the last month, certainly in the last couple of weeks. Senator Clinton's talking about virtually nothing else. She's got a stimulus plan that she's promoting. She criticized President Bush just a few minutes ago here in Las Vegas. She said the plan that he unveiled this morning wasn't adequate, that it left out 50 million people. Obama also has an economic stimulus plan that he's discussing, as does Senator Edwards. They're acutely aware that this is what voters are concerned about right now. It's a very different environment than it was a year ago when they all first started running, when the Iraq War was really the issue that everybody wanted to talk about, certainly in Democratic audiences. And they spent, large portions of their question and answer time responding to concerns people had about the war. Those have largely gone away, which is not to say that people aren't concerned about the war anymore, but it doesn't seem to be the front burner that it once was. People are really concerned about their jobs. They're concerned about health care. They're concerned about how they're going to pay for their kids' college. You can just tell that people feel very, very vulnerable to the vagaries of our economic situation at the moment.
Clarence, it's also a time of mergers. There was the takeover bid of Countrywide by Bank of America. Now the New York Stock Exchange saying it's going to buy the American Stock Exchange. They've been rivals. Is that also a sign that America is shifting permanently, not just politically but economically?
Yeah, it is. It certainly shows that the economic terrain is shifting depending on the investments that these large corporations made, large financial companies made in recent years. Everything we've read or heard about, or in many cases experienced with the subprime mortgage meltdown, has made formerly strong companies quite vulnerable to takeovers. And that's indicative of, I think, a rising issue here in the campaign. If you'd asked me the question you asked Marcus about what the next issue is going to be, I would say, I can't predict, but we certainly see the economy rising, which should help John Edwards, you would think, since he's made a bigger issue out of his populist pitch than anybody. But he hasn't connected in a way that has risen above the emotional impact of race and gender. Now, with all three candidates coming out with their own plans, I'm waiting to see them relate that to ordinary people. Like, if you've lost your job and you can find another one in another state that's looking for your talent, will you be able to sell your house if it is worth less than what you paid for it?
Well, Clarence, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Marcus and Beth, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
We have been speaking with Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times, and Beth Fooey, Associated Press. Meet Ella Coney. Her story begins more than 35 years ago in the Denver housing projects. She was a single parent of two facing jail time for welfare fraud. She spoke to us for our series Great Expectations, and first, Ella Coney took me back to 1973 and that make or break moment in her life.
I had my first child when I was 17 years old. Very shortly thereafter, I had another one, and my mother let me know, okay, if you want to be grown and have these babies, you need to get out on your own and raise them. And so I moved into the projects. In the projects, I saw grandmothers who had raised their kids in the projects. Those kids were being raised in the projects. And those kids' kids were being raised in the projects. And I said, I can't stay here. I've got to find some way to get out of this.
What did you do?
It was a really interesting story. The $200 that I was getting on welfare was barely enough to make ends meet. I was always robbing Peter to pay Paul, and so I took some part-time jobs. But I did not know I was young and very uneducated, that you have to report all of your income to the welfare department. And so two investigators came and told me, we know you've been working while you're on welfare. We've got all the records, and we're going to recommend that you do jail time. So I'm 3 months behind on my rent. My rent is $3. I can't come up with $9 for rent. I'm looking at jail time, and I'm desperate. I'm sitting on a bus stop. I see a sign of Uncle Sam in a red, white, and blue top hat that says, "We want you." And I went in and talked with the military recruiter, and the rest is history from there.
How did it feel to you when you went into the military? You had to leave your children behind, is that correct?
Yes, I had to leave them with my father, and that was very, very difficult for me. But I'm going to quote Denzel in his movie, The Great Debaters. You do what you have to today so you can do what you want to do tomorrow. And I knew that that was something that I had to do.
In one of your diary entries from 1983, you said, "I joined the military in January 1974. I was young and impressionable and ready to tackle the world." When was the moment after you joined the military that you felt most vulnerable? Was there a moment when you said, you know what, things are not quite what I expected them to be?
Well, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had done the civil rights movement. He had marched and gotten us a lot of rights and privileges that we ordinarily wouldn't have had. And I thought that discrimination was over. It was gone. And I was not prepared for not only the sexual, but the racial discrimination that I ran into that was just very blatant.
So almost all of your colleagues were white men, I'm assuming?
Yes, they were.
Did you feel harassed at any point?
You had to fight constantly for your place. You were given menial jobs. You had to work long hours. I was told that black people were too stupid to be in that job. And finally, I had a total and complete mental breakdown. And I was discharged from the military. And I was devastated that I just couldn't do it.
After you left the military, you took a completely different turn with your life into what is the inspiration for the cover of the book, which shows you lying in a pile of Benjamins. How did you get to that point where you were covered in $100 bills from the point where you had left on a medical discharge?
Well, you know, I'm at home, I'm disabled, I can't do anything, and I see this man next door working on this property. He's cutting the grass, he's trimming the bushes, and one day I went out and asked him, "Don't you have a job? Why are you over here in the middle of the day?" And he said, "This is my job. I take care of my properties." And I was so intrigued. Every once in a while, you run across somebody that affects your life in such a powerful way that they alter your destiny. They believe in you. They encourage you. They share their wisdom with you. But most of all, they let you learn by experience what can happen if you take control of your own destiny. Mr. KG was his own man. He was a man's man. He was living his dream. And I saw that it could be done, and I vowed to follow in his footsteps and do it also. And so I went out and bought my very first piece of real estate, and that was the greatest thing I could have ever done.
You, despite all of the challenges that you faced, went on to become a millionaire and now run a company with your own son. When you hear it put like that, do you consider yourself safe? Not just a success, but do you consider yourself safe that my life is going to keep moving forward in a positive path?
You know, I'd like to think that, you know, your thoughts have a big part of who you are in life. But I know that I am not safe. I am a very conservative millionaire. I wear jeans and T-shirts and tennis shoes frequently. I drive a 12-year-old car. I have the smallest house on the block, and I clip coupons. I understand that if my money is not spent very wisely, that it can get away from me. But my goal is to have a comfortable retirement and leave a legacy for my kids, a foundation that they can build upon.
Are they taking your advice?
It took them until they hit their 30s, but yes, both of my boys graduated from college and they own a couple of pieces of real estate, and my daughter's working on her little legacy, but yes, they understand the power behind accumulating, appreciating assets.
As far as advice goes, if you had to meet someone who had had a crisis that landed them in the hospital for mental health issues, or someone who had been fired from a job, or someone who'd been arrested, any of the number of difficulties you'd faced, and they were completely hopeless about their own life, how would you describe to them why they should keep on keeping on?
Right, that is a very good question. I would tell them to dream. Don't be afraid to dream, because dreams come true. Set goals. Write those goals down. And once you have a plan, take action. Educate yourself. Prepare yourself. And when that perfect opportunity presents itself, grab it and never look back.
Well, that's a perfect place to end it. Ella, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai. It was a pleasure.
That was author and real estate millionaire investor Ella Coney. Her new memoir is called When You Fall Down, Get Up. She was at member station KUVO in Denver, Colorado. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes. She is a campaign diehard. Michelle Obama is right by her husband's side, up on the big stage, down in the crowd, shaking hands with voters. Or she can go it solo in front of fans and undecided voters. Last month in Iowa, she took the stage and worked up the crowd.
And we need to have someone who can speak to our souls, because our problem is that we have holes in our souls. And I am married to the only man in this race who has a chance of even beginning to address that fundamental problem, Barack Obama.
Allison Samuels of Newsweek magazine got a chance to spend some quality time with Michelle Obama. Her feature on the possible future first lady hits stands next week. Allison, always great to talk to you.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing great. So you must have had a great weekend, last weekend, interviewing Michelle Obama. Tell me about when you first met her. What was the moment that kind of crystallized who she was for you?
I guess the moment that did that for me is when she walked into the room and, like, you know, gave me this hug. She's like, hey, how you doing? It's just sort of like this friendly girlfriend hug, like we had known each other for years. I think that was, you know, just her being comfortable within her own skin and just sort of, you know, being very happy to meet people and enjoying just sort of the process of greeting people and knowing that she has to do that, you know, to sort of, you know, get people to know her and the husband and the family. And she's very good at it.
It's been a turbulent week in politics. Yes. And you were talking to her during this time when there's been all this talk about Clinton, Obama, race, color, you know, strategy, blah, blah, blah. How did she deal with that?
She seemed to be doing fine. I think that she said that she expected a lot of this to happen, not so soon, but she certainly saw it coming. I think she didn't necessarily see the Bob Johnson comments coming. I think those were a little frustrating for her. But overall, I think she handled it really well. I think that, you know, for her as an African-American woman, and she really does take pride in that, I think, you know, it was disappointing to have someone like Bob Johnson come out and make the statement he made. And her quote to me was like, I don't know what he's talking about, and he clearly doesn't know what he's talking about either. So I can't get concerned when these kind of things happen. But in terms of Hillary Clinton and Martin Luther King, she was very clear that, you know, she knows that the Clintons understand the legacy of Martin Luther King, but felt that it was just a very poor choice of words on Hillary's part to sort of describe his importance in the manner that she did.
Now, back in November, Barack Obama was trailing Senator Clinton in the polls, and Michelle did an interview with MSNBC. She talked about why black voters were so reluctant to support her husband back then, a black candidate running for president. Here's a clip.
What we're dealing with in the black community is just
the natural fear of possibility. That's the psychology that's going on in our heads, in our souls, and I understand it. I know where it comes from, you know, and I think that it's one of the horrible legacies of racism. It keeps a people down in their souls in a way, you know, where they sometimes can't move beyond it.
Senator Barack Obama is not just multiracial, but multicultural, grew up many different places, and Michelle's from the south side of Chicago. So how would you compare the history and the culture that she brings to how she views race to her husband?
Well, I think they have a slightly different view. I think he's definitely very hopeful and very optimistic. I think she's more of a realist, but I think that she believes that his vision of what America can be can actually happen. I think in many ways, I love the fact that they're sort of opposites on some level, because I think she's able to sort of get in his ear and talk to him about certain things. And I also think for him in this national, it's very hard for him to actually talk about race without being described as the black candidate. And I think what the campaign has done, and I think what she's done, is decided, you know, she can do that. She can go to South Carolina. I saw it in Atlanta at the Trumpet Awards, which was a primarily African-American audience. And she could deliver that speech, and she could talk about what it meant to be a black girl from south side of Chicago who can now possibly be the first lady, you know, African-American first lady. So I think that the campaign has, you know, sort of knows that she's a secret, well, not even so secret, but a very powerful weapon, and that she's very much, you know, when you get him, he's sort of cool and brainy, and she's very warm. And you look at her and you know, what her history is, what her background is. And I think they complement each other really well.
Now, you yourself have said, I get Barack through looking at Michelle. What do you mean? Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there have been all these different things about him. Oh, is he black enough? Is he this? You know, he didn't have the traditional African-American experience. You hear that so much. But I, for me, when I see Michelle, I get him. I understand that he understands the African-American experience, because I'm pretty sure she's very clear about it with him. She talks to him about it. She's certainly experienced it. I think the main thing for Obama is that he grew up in Hawaii with his grandparents, which is worlds away from what traditional African-Americans sort of experienced. They didn't have that type of lifestyle. But he has Michelle there to actually, if he doesn't know, I think she's telling him and she advises him. And from what she describes of their marriage, they talk all the time about everything. And I think he really respects her and appreciates her opinion. So I sort of feel like I get the man by the woman that he married. And she's this very strong, powerful woman. And I think it takes a very strong, powerful man to actually marry a very strong, powerful woman. And so, I totally get him when I look at her.
Now, she talks a lot about her children in stump speeches and elsewhere. Here's a clip from her video on the Barack Obama campaign website.
Our girls, Malia and Sasha, are the light of our lives. You know, they keep us grounded and whole. And what we are reminded of every day when we see them is that every child should be able to enjoy what they enjoy, that freedom of just having so much opportunity.
Now, Michelle Obama is a lawyer. She has worked in politics. She's just someone who is, you know, she's definitely part of a power couple. How does she balance that aspect of her own desires and ambitions with being a mom and being the wife of a candidate?
Well, I think she's, you know, reduced her role as a lawyer, and she was working for a hospital in Chicago, and I think she's reduced that role to sort of help Barack run for president. And she prides herself on her role as mother. She only campaigns twice or two days out of the week, so she can be home with the girls. And she made a very interesting statement. She said that they didn't make the decision for their lives to become like this. So it was Barack and her decision to decide, yes, we're going to turn our lives upside down and you know, and become, you know, sort of candidates in this race. But she felt like the girls did make that decision. So she wanted their lives to be as normal as possible for as long as they could. And I think that was, you know, very interesting. And any mother, I think, or any woman can understand why you would want to be there. You know, because they're at a very, you know, important age, six and nine. I mean, you want to be there and you want them to know that, you know, you haven't abandoned them. You're not all over the country and they're at home watching you on TV. She said she didn't want that for her girls.
When Senator Obama came on our show, I asked if he was concerned basically about someone trying to kill him, basically on the standpoint of him being a father and would they be fatherless if he goes ahead and runs for president. Did she ever express any concerns about what this might do to him, her, or their family?
Well, she said, you know, that obviously there is a concern, and obviously something bad could happen, but she couldn't live in fear, and that basically none of us can, and particularly African Americans, because she feels as though that's why so many African Americans are hesitant to support him, is because they feel like something bad could happen to him. It's interesting because she said after Iowa, she hasn't had as many African Americans come up to her and say, oh, aren't you afraid that he's going to be killed? For some reason, I guess after Iowa, they sort of got it that, oh, yeah, maybe people like him, maybe he can win. But she said she feels like that's a very big factor in why a lot of blacks are worried about him and don't really know if they want to vote for him. But for her, she said she's let that go because she feels like this is what he was meant to do. And, you know, it will take care of itself.
Well, Allison, look forward to getting the full scoop in the magazine.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Her story on Michelle Obama is featured in next week's issue, and she spoke with us from NPR's New York studios. As we gear up for our trip to South Carolina, we want to get a sense of the local flavor in politics. To give us some perspective, we got Cynthia Hardy. She hosts a statewide call-in talk show called On Point with Cynthia Hardy. It's based at station WWDM in Columbia. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Farai. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, we're delighted. So your show covers most of the state, and you probably get a bunch of different views on the issues that people in South Carolina care about. What are you hearing? What's the major issue or two?
Well, you know, people are really excited about the positioning that South Carolina has as the launching pad as we, you know, look at Super Tuesday on February 5th. It's interesting because I think particularly in the African-American community, people understand that all eyes are on the community to see what it's going to do. And it's been very interesting to see how people are lining up. If you notice, the polls are indicating that Senator Obama is ahead of Senator Clinton by about 7-8 points. But when you're here on the ground, it's really hard to tell. I was at the hairdresser this morning, and I got to tell you, it almost came to blows in there. I'm talking 6 o'clock. We girls are in there at 6 o'clock in the morning trying to get it done so we can get into work on time. And owner of the salon happened to be an Obama supporter. And she has done the Women for Obama thing, really been a part of that movement, hosted things at her house and at the salon. So she's passing out buttons and she's putting stickers on people. And several people who were Hillary Clinton supporters, of course, politely turned down the sticker. And so that led into a debate about what people think and why they think it. And it was very, very interesting. It was a big Obama-Clinton face-off. What was good was how passionate people are, but also what came out of that was if you're African-American, somehow, if you are African-American and not supporting Obama, a number of African-American people think you've done something wrong. So having to overcome that seemed to be a little bit problematic for a number of the people who were not supporting Obama.
Now, speaking of your hairdresser, how has she dealt with the economic issues? Have they been hitting her?
Well, as a matter of fact, they really have. You know, South Carolina is one of the southern states that is primarily rural. So when the economic downturns happen across the country, we feel it a lot more strongly, say, than some of the other parts of the country. We're not talking recession very much in this country right now, but a number of people are really, really feeling it here in South Carolina. We are looking at the foreclosure rate. It's 3 to 4 times what it's been the last 4 to 5 years. People just don't have what they used to have. My hairdresser made a comment to me a couple of weeks ago that people were having a hard time paying her and asking if they could, you know, wait for a week or so, you know, before they were able to, before they could pay. And her mention to me was, if you have an opportunity, Cynthia, to host a show about the impending recession, you should do that because times are harder than people really are talking about.
Now, the Democrats have a strong presence. Most of the black folks are going to go out for the Democratic race. But what about black Republicans? The primary is tomorrow. What candidate are people gravitating towards?
Interesting. You know, the polls say one thing, but we learned something from New Hampshire, didn't we? I took the temperature, say, of a number of the listeners of my show. And of the black Republicans, there's a growing sense that people like Mitt Romney. And It seems a little odd to people, I would imagine. Some of the criticisms of John McCain, a number of African-American Republicans when faced with the decision between McCain and Huckabee and Romney, they choose Romney and then Huckabee. And their rationale, of course, is they'd like to have someone who has dealt with the people, in there with the people. They like the fact that Romney has experience in dealing with the Olympics. They like the fact that he has business savvy. In McCain's case, they think he's too old. A number of my listeners feel like if he's elected at 71, then he'd be 79 if he had the opportunity to serve a second term. And so that alarms a number of people when looking at, and I know what it is, it's all the fresh newness on the other side with the Democratic candidates. When you look at the youthfulness of a Barack Obama or the newness of a Hillary Clinton, it's easy to see why on the other side people would want a little bit of fresh and new as well.
Now, what about John Edwards? This is his birth state, and he is looking for a win. How's his campaign, how's his Bring It Home slogan playing with the home crowd?
You know, it's hard to tell because there is so much noise around Senator Clinton and around Barack Obama and around the front runners in the Republican Party. I think there's an endearing feeling for John Edwards because, you know, he won here last time and people like him. He's a folksy guy. He feels like someone you can, you know, talk to and tell your problems to. But at the end of the day, you know, people didn't elect him last time around, and the feeling is that, you know, he's just not the pick. While you have a number of people, you know, you've got a fair amount of people in our state who are looking at John Edwards, and a number of folks are saying, you better watch those numbers because they think he'll, you know, start to increase as we get closer and closer to the Democratic primary. But it really, I don't think that his message has taken root the way that he would like for it to in South Carolina, because as folks say, for you to be a winner, you got to win some. And he hasn't won any yet. And I don't think that this will be the place where he will get a win.
This is going to have to be very short, but your state has so much history, so much culture, the Gullah culture, beaches, history of slavery and emancipation. If you could use a couple of words or phrases to describe the character of South Carolinians, what would it be?
You know, a number of the people in South Carolina are pretty insightful. They recognize where they've been, and the journey has not been nearly what they've wanted it to be. There's a lot of apathy in our state because people have not had the victories, you know, that a number of other places have. That's why this election is so significant, because what we're feeling is a put down of the apathy and so much passion that's rising up. It's a very exciting time to be in South Carolina right now, especially with this very special presidential primary coming up as far as the Democrats are concerned. A lot of involvement on the part of people where there was not any involvement before. So I think that there's a lot of insightful thought going on now about where we've been, what has happened, the kinds of things that have held people back, and the possibilities that are opening because of the messages of the candidates that are leading the pack.
A hopeful time?
It is a very hopeful time. You know, a number of the candidates are talking about, even though Barack Obama led the way with the hope and the faith, a number of folks are talking that talk now. Edwards talks about it when he talks about the loss of his son, the illness of his wife. Hillary Clinton talks about her United Methodist roots a lot. And, you know, she's got a lot of African-American support from the pulpit. But I want to mention to you that that support from the pulpit does not transfer necessarily to the membership. And I think that people will be surprised by that. A number of people have assumed, because when you see her standing and so many of the African-American pastors in South Carolina standing behind her, that means that will be the way that their congregations will go. And
Cindy,
I caution that that certainly isn't the case.
All right. It's been great talking to you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Cynthia Hardy is the host of On Point with Cynthia Hardy. That's a weekly call-in talk show on WWDM in Columbia, South Carolina. That's news and notes for today. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce the show. Denise Rios edits and Taylor Chapeline Orsia is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell is our drive engineer, and our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, Christopher Johnson, Devin Robbins, Kenya Young, and Anthea Raymond. Our interns are Drew Tewksbury and Paige Lindell. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.